Good afternoon. May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Emmett Taylor. Even though defense counsel thoroughly prepared for Mr. Taylor's trial, discussed their strategy with him, and had no intent to waive any of his fundamental rights without his consent, the trial court prevented them from pursuing a strategy that was consistent with his objective and that had the best chance to save his life. This denied his Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
And what was his objective?
His objective was to plead not guilty and to put the state to the test of their case. And that was also the defense counsel's objective. And what happened in this case is that the trial court, prior to trial, had learned that there was a divide between the two. Counsel wanted to achieve that objective by pursuing alternative arguments as to state of mind and a guilty but mentally ill verdict. Mr. Taylor, on the other hand, wanted to pursue self-defense or accident and wanted no mention of mental health issues.
Can you tell me where in the record it's documented that defense counsel ever told the trial judge that the strategy was to address the guilty but mentally ill for lesser included offenses, but not for intentional murder?
Well, I don't think they specifically said that. What they told the court repeatedly was that our defense is going to be that if the defendant was a person that was responsible for the death of Stephanie Mumford, he wasn't acting intentionally at the time that occurred. Unlike Cook, we have no intention of standing up and admitting to this jury that the defendant committed these offenses and your only determination is his state of mind. The court confirmed their strategy by asking, "You would certainly ask for something less than intentional," to which counsel responded, "Absolutely."
You would what?
"You would certainly ask for something less than intentional," to which he responded, "Absolutely."
Well, what I'm trying to get straight in my mind is how you tie in the trial judge having had the opportunity to address a theory that our strategy is to plead not guilty, put the state to its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt on the issue of the mens rea of intent, and not say anything about mentally ill. But when we get to lesser included offenses that might be justified, we want to be able to introduce the concept that he may be guilty of the lesser included offense, but the explanation of that guilt is he was mentally ill.
I don't think that's what their intent was. I think what it was clear from the record.
Well, is that part of your argument, though, that that's where there was error by not allowing that to get a new trial where that could happen?
Yes. I'm sorry.
Here's my problem. If it wasn't presented to the trial judge in the way in which it's being presented to us, how can we be expected to resolve it?
With respect, Your Honor, I think it was presented to the trial court as it's being presented to you today. What defense counsel sought to do was
Maybe I interrupted you too early and don't understand the thrust of your argument.
Well, here's the thrust of the argument. Defense counsel sought a strategy that included an arsenal of options, one of which was to have him found not guilty on everything, one of which was an alternative defense that if you're going to find him guilty, and as the law states, you can say, if you believe the state's case, find him guilty. But if you find him guilty, you must also find him mentally ill. Or they can also argue, if you find him guilty of murder second, you can also find him guilty mentally ill. So the options were all there, and I think that was clear on the record. And I think the court, even after they made its ruling, well, actually, the court summarized their strategy as, you could get a lesser verdict. If you do not get a lesser verdict, at the end of the day, you're hoping for a lesser penalty. So it was part of their arsenal. And he took that part, that strategy away from them in achieving the same objective that Mr. Taylor wanted.
Is that the record evidence that the trial judge had before him, an argument that we seek to put the state to its proof beyond a reasonable doubt of intentional murder, and if they fail to do so, we expect a not guilty? But in the event that the jury decides no intentional murder, we drop back to second degree or manslaughter. As to those, we expect the jury to consider him potentially guilty but mentally ill. But we don't want guilty but mentally ill as an option for intentional murder.
They never said that, and no one's argued that they never said that. What we're stating today is that being one of the options is perfectly appropriate under both Cook and Nixon.
Well, then, maybe just tell us the legal error, because I share the Chief Justice's confusion.
Here's the error. Defense counsel sought to pursue a strategy that included guilty but mentally ill.
On what charge?
On both the three charges that were before the court. The murder first, the weapon, and the abuse of the corpse. And they sought to also get lesser included verdicts.
All right, so you remember our decision in Red Dog in 1993?
Yes.
We said that a competent defendant gets to choose the objectives.
Yes.
In this case, no one made a motion to have Taylor declared incompetent.
Correct.
So the objectives were his to make.
Correct.
If the defense counsel said, we think guilty but mentally ill is consistent with your objective, and he said, I disagree, what happens?
What happens then is the court should follow this court's ruling in Cook versus State, which is to conduct an inquiry to determine the propriety of the strategy that's to be employed. The client gets to choose the objective. He does not get to pick how we get there. He does not have to understand how we get there. Defense counsel said, we agree with you. We're not going to admit guilt. We're going to try to put the state to its proof, but we're also going to put these options on the table.
And does this work in private practice also? And let's assume hypothetically someone's charged with first-degree murder, and they go to a private attorney. He said, my retainer is $150,000. He's paid $150,000. The defendant says, not guilty. That's it. Put the state to their burden of proof. And the lawyer says, thank you very much for your money, and I understand your objective, and I'm going to achieve it, and I'm going to pursue guilty but mentally ill. And the defendant says to the private attorney, I didn't pay you $150,000 to pursue guilty but mentally ill. Not guilty, only not guilty, that's it. What happens?
Well, assuming that the attorney is ethical, he would move to withdraw in that case, which is what counsel did in this case, but were not permitted to do so. And that's the problem that we're faced with. The client has a right to counsel, and his right to counsel includes effective assistance of counsel. If he does not agree with the strategy employed to achieve his objective, then he does not have to exercise, he can exercise his right to represent himself. And that's the difference between the right to counsel and the right to represent yourself. What comes with it is the strategy that the attorney knows based on their skill.
So you're saying if the client says, this is my objective, and you're not pursuing my objective, and the attorney doesn't have to fall in line with the client's objective and how the client wants to achieve it, and the attorney can simply say, I'm withdrawing, and he can represent him or she can represent themselves.
The attorney must seek the defendant's objective. There's no dispute there. The difference we have here, for example, between this case and Cook, the defendant's objective was to plead not guilty and put the state to its case. He had one theory of doing that. Defense counsel also wanted to plead not guilty and have the state be put to its proof. And they had another strategy to do that. In Cook versus State, it was the manner in which they pursued the guilty but mentally ill strategy, where they only sought guilty but mentally ill as the verdict, and he wanted not guilty. And that objective was inconsistent, similar to Red Dog versus State, where the objective of the defendant was to stop pursuing appeals, a personal right to him. And defense counsel said, no, I'm going to waive your fundamental right because it's my objective to go ahead and pursue an appeal. And this court said if that was repugnant to the counsel, they shouldn't do that. They need to withdraw. And these attorneys were put in a spot where they had an objective the same as their client. The trial court did not look to that. The trial court read Cook versus State as a per se rule, saying anytime defendant does not want a guilty but mentally ill verdict pursued, you can't do it. And that's not what Cook says. What Cook says is that if that's what they want to do, if that's what the attorneys want to do, the court must conduct an inquiry into the propriety. Must look to see, do you intend to admit guilt, as they did in Cook. They admitted guilt in the opening. They presented evidence against their client. They refused to put their client on to testify. They admitted guilt and eligibility again in the closing.
Here, let me go back to square one again, because despite the help from Justice Holland, I remain confused. When was the trial judge, if ever, put on notice that both the defendant and defense counsel wished to pursue guilty but mentally ill on lesser included offenses of first degree murder?
Throughout several of the hearings, Your Honor, and I would say that the I think the statements that I cited to the court makes it clear that they sought to go for lesser included offenses.
Well, clearly you understand I'm having a problem reaching the same conclusion.
I understand, Your Honor.
That what you've cited has made it clear. Can you give me some appendix pages that will
Your Honor,
help me?
Yes, the entirety, and there were other comments made by the counsel, and I do cite, to be honest here, the state's appendix is much more clear than mine, so I do cite to theirs. B-150 to 151 is an April 9th pretrial hearing, and also 153. The April 16th hearing, B-209 to 210, and after the fact, on September 2nd, after the ruling, at B-327, when at that point, after the court had ruled, defense counsel said, well, you know, because the client brought this issue up again, he said, I thought it was clear all along we weren't going to admit guilt and we were going to also pursue guilty but mentally ill as an option. And but now we're not going to do that because of the ruling. And the court said, okay, everybody's on the same page. It took Hook to get us here, but now we're on the same page. So in a reading of the entire context.
And that was to all charges, not just lesser included offenses. This comment about we wanted to put the state to its proof, but we also wanted to pursue guilty but mentally ill?
Yes.
As to the charge of murder in the first degree?
As to the charge of murder in the first degree, as well as any of the lesser included.
And you believe the record reflects that both the defendant and trial counsel wanted the intentional murder count, murder in the first degree, not the lesser included offenses, to be both put the state to its proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but on the other hand, simultaneously seek guilty but mentally ill consideration from the jury for the intentional murder count?
No, the client was never on board with it. That was the problem. I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I am not making this clear. The context of the entirety of the pretrial hearings was that defense counsel, and they told him, the judge, up front, we want to go guilty but mentally ill. We want to pursue that verdict. Mr. Taylor is telling us, no, he wants self-defense, and he wants accident. And he doesn't want any mention of mental health. So as they go along with their conversations and the court inquires, the attorney at that time had listened to the oral arguments in Cook and made sure he put on the record, we do not intend to admit guilt. I don't believe that the court will find a specific statement where he says, we're going to seek guilty but mentally ill on murder first degree, and if we don't get that, excuse me, we're going to seek not guilty. Right. And if we don't get that, we want a lesser included. And if we don't get that, we want guilty but mentally ill. That is not spelled out. What is spelled out for the court is we're going to use guilty but mentally ill, and we're going to seek alternative arguments. To the extent it's not clear, Your Honor, I believe that is an abuse, or excuse me, not in compliance with Cook. Because that's what Cook was designed. It says that the court should inquire into that. It should have been made perfectly clear after Cook. They should have had an inquiry where the judge says, okay, tell me exactly what your strategy is and what do you intend to waive? Do you intend to use this for murder first degree? So if it is unclear, that's because the court did not follow Cook's instruction as it was required to do.
Isn't it clear here that Mr. Taylor wanted to pursue factual innocence?
Yes.
So guilty but mentally ill is inconsistent with that, isn't it?
And so is guilty, and yet in the instructions and during closing, counsel can argue, can say to the jury, if you believe the state's case, you have to find him guilty. that if you believe the self-defense, then you need to find Mr. Taylor not guilty. What's wrong with him then saying, and if you find him guilty, you must also find him mentally ill?
Let's go back to the objective. We agree, after Red Dog and clearly after Cook, if you're competent, you get to select the objective. Here you just indicated Mr. Taylor's objective was not to put his mental health in issue. Wasn't that one of his objectives?
That was the way he wanted to achieve his objective. That is not the objective. The objective was to be found, I would imagine, not guilty by pleading not guilty and having the state put to its test.
Well, there are a lot of ways to have your mental health in issue other than being found guilty but mentally ill. You can talk about diminished capacity and all sorts of other things.
Correct.
But he didn't want any suggestion to the jury that he was guilty in any way. Is that true?
I believe that's correct.
So if, you know, it's really a misnomer to call guilty but mentally ill a defense. It's not a defense.
Right, it's a mitigating circumstance.
So if he didn't want guilt in any fashion, including guilty but mentally ill, why wasn't pursuing that inconsistent with his objective?
Because when an attorney gets up and argues, for example, let's take guilty but mentally ill out of this. Let's say we're dealing with murder first degree. And I argue to the jury that he didn't do it. But if you think he did it, then he's guilty of murder second degree. I believe that everyone would conclude that's entirely appropriate. And that's exactly what they intended to do here. They wanted to say he didn't do it. But if you conclude that the state was correct, you must also find him mentally ill.
Well, when you say everyone would agree, it's appropriate if they agreed. Who do you mean by they? Both the defendant sought that as his objective and defense counsel thought it to be the best strategy?
No, I'm sorry. What I meant is I think legal scholars would agree that you can seek alternative arguments. So you could argue he's not guilty of murder first, but if you believe he did something, he's guilty of murder second.
No, I think we'll all accept the inconsistent pleading, inconsistent arguments, alternative strategies all coming out of counsel's mouth at the same trial. We're all, who've done trial work, we've all faced that problem from time to time. But we're talking here about making sure the record reflects that whatever that strategy in the alternative may have been, it is also the objective sought by the defendant, and the defendant agrees with that strategy. You're not arguing that the defendant can say, I don't want anything presented to the jury that suggests that I'm mentally ill, yet on the other hand, counsel can present a guilty but mentally ill alternative as it applies to lesser included offenses of intentional murder. So the defendant's self-defense is rejected. The defendant's argument that the state hasn't established intentional murder beyond a reasonable doubt is rejected. Does the record reflect the defendant was on board with an alternative position that if I lose on that and you have my consent to argue to the jury that if they find the facts consistent beyond a reasonable doubt with second-degree murder or manslaughter, you can present to them that I'm guilty but mentally ill of those lesser-included offenses?
No, he wasn't on board with that at all.
Okay.
That respectfully, under Nixon and Cook, is not relevant in this case unless the strategy that defense counsel sought to achieve would waive his fundamental rights, and it would not have. In Nixon versus Florida versus Nixon, the court said, yes, in that case, that the client sat silent. But there's no difference between someone sitting silent and objecting because a guilty plea can't be entered any more upon a defendant's silence than it can upon an objection. What Nixon turned on was the difference between entering a guilty plea versus a reasoned strategy that includes a concession of guilt. And that's what we had here. In Cook, it was completely different. Their method of pursuing the guilty but mentally ill did waive his fundamental rights.
Do you agree that guilty but mentally ill is not a lesser included offense?
Yes, I agree with that.
So that if the defense counsel argues in the alternative to find the defendant guilty but mentally ill. He's arguing to find the defendant guilty.
No. What one would do with the guilty but mentally ill is present it as an option to the jury. When you are in closing argument, you argue for the innocence. He's not guilty to murder first. You can say, because it's the law and they're instructed on that, and but if you believe the state's case, he's guilty. That's not arguing counter to your client's objective. That's pointing out the law.
But so, in a capital case, which is bifurcated, we have the guilt phase and the penalty phase. And being found guilty but mentally ill may have some advantages in the penalty phase.
Correct.
In the guilt phase, if you're found guilty but mentally ill, you're going to serve the same amount of time. The only question is, where are you going to serve it?
Correct.
So as a practical matter, you're being found guilty, and there's no advantage to the defendant at all, is there?
Yes, there is, because what happens then is that's a statutory, not statutory, it's a mitigator as a matter of law.
That's important at the penalty
yes.
phase. But this person had a bifurcated proceeding, and his objective at the guilt phase was to be found not guilty,
right.
not guilty but mentally ill.
Right. And his objective was not to be found guilty. Yet, when you point out the evidence, and you can tell the jury, if you find him guilty, an alternative argument, if you find him guilty, you must also find him mentally ill. In Cook, what they did was they made no alternative arguments. The entire time they said, find him guilty but mentally ill, find him guilty but mentally ill, find him guilty. They didn't give him the argument, he's not guilty. And Nixon, they did.
Well, let's suppose we have an extremely sophisticated defendant. And then the defendant says to his lawyer, your alternative is one that the jury is going to seize upon. And to the extent I want to be found not guilty, and you suggest to them, if they want to find me guilty but mentally ill, you're compromising my ability to achieve my objective being not guilty by holding out to the jury the prospect of finding me guilty but mentally ill. So I don't want that at all. Isn't that something that a sophisticated defendant may say? And as I understand your argument, if they do, the lawyer has a right to say, well, that's your point of view, but we're not doing that.
That's correct. They have the duty to achieve their objective. If the attorney, based on his training and experience, feels the best way to do that is his way versus the defendant's way, then that controls.
Well, doesn't that kind of move away from the effective assistance of counsel into simply saying it's counsel's case? I mean, whose case is it?
It's the defendant's case. But if we allow every single defendant to control their cases, which is what happened here, they said you can't undermine his self-defense. So the defendant got to get up there and say it's self-defense, which defense counsel knew would thwart his case. And what's the point of having attorneys there except to perhaps escort them to the death chamber?
Well, I think Cook spoke to that, didn't they? And we found out 3-2, there is no point. Cook was analyzed under Cronic, not under Strickland.
That's correct, because in Cook, there was a complete failure to test the state's case. Here and in Nixon, there wasn't. And that's why the court was required at the very least to conduct some type of inquiry into the propriety of the way that the strategy was going to play out.
You have 1 minute left. You want to save your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. First, Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to thank the court for the accommodation you gave to me today to start this argument a little bit later. It's been a busy morning already. The real question in this case is whether or not Cook left any room open for defense counsel to override the decision of a competent defendant and impose a guilt-based defense over his objection. And the state suggests
isn't that somewhat of an oxymoron to say it's a guilt-based defense? We agree that guilty but mentally ill is not a defense.
A guilt-based, I guess, defensive strategy.
Right.
Because really what you're seeking is, and in the capital circumstance, the tertiary benefit during your penalty phase, but as the court rightly pointed out, you still end up being found guilty of murder in the first degree. Actually, you still end up being subjected to the potential of the death penalty. You just have this legally, one of the only legally recognized mitigators that the trial court must instruct upon.
Your reference to a tertiary benefit was very artful. It's a fairly important benefit, isn't it? Being able to argue consistently to the jury in the guilt phase that what we're really talking about here, if the state fails to prove beyond a reasonable doubt intentional murder, we're talking about somebody who's guilty, but the explanation for their guilt is mental illness. And having a consistent argument before the same jury that's going to sit in the penalty phase is crucially important if your objective is saving the defendant's life when the facts are overwhelmingly consistent with his guilt.
True.
And
absolutely.
The tertiary benefit you're referring to is death, correct? Avoiding the death penalty?
Well, Your Honor, it's not necessarily avoiding the death penalty because, in fact, you still will be subjected to a penalty phase. But the reality is this. All of us in this room, as we sit here coolly as attorneys, may say that is the best possible course for him. No doubt defense attorneys should take that course if they can. But the question is if they can. And this court held in Cook that under the Sixth Amendment, they cannot. Because in the end, that defense, or that defensive strategy, or however we want to call it, that seeking of that verdict is something that is personal to the criminal defendant. Just as you cannot go in and say, you know what, Emmett, the best thing for us to do is actually go in and plead guilty in front of the judge so that when we have the penalty phase, we can tell the jury, look, you admitted what you did and everything else. They can no more do that. Than they can here. We may sit, or in defense, not we, because I'm always on the other side of the courtroom, but criminal defense counsel may say, this is absolutely the best thing for him. It would be the best thing to plead this guy guilty. But he has that right not to. And this court said that guilty but mentally ill is so akin to that in a trial because you are basically going in, whether it's one of the arrows in your quiver of defense or whether or not it is the full defense, it is still going in front of the jury and saying, this person is factually guilty of intentional murder.
Well,
but
let's back up a little bit. In Cook, defense counsel, from start to finish, said to the jury, our man is guilty.
Yes.
And that was held to be a failure. A complete failure of providing him a defense, right?
Yes.
Okay. So here we have somebody who also doesn't want the guilty but mentally ill plea. But the difference, if I understand it correctly, is that defense counsel was not going to get up at the beginning and say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, our guy is guilty but mentally ill. The defense counsel was going to get up and say it was an accident or it was self-defense. He's not guilty. And then there'd be all this evidence about what didn't happen. And included in that evidence, I assume, would be some medical expert who would provide evidence of the defendant's mental capacity. And then at the end, defense counsel still would be arguing, ladies and gentlemen, find my client not guilty, but would also be saying, you know, however, if you're inclined, you know, if you believe the evidence supports a finding of guilt, then find him guilty but mentally ill. Isn't that a very different level of defense being provided?
Not so much, Your Honor. And the reason is that yes, the employment of the strategy between Cook and perhaps this case would have been different in certain respects, except for this. You must also affirmatively prove that the person is mentally ill. It would have meant that the defense counsel has to put on a medical expert who says, yes, he did this. He intentionally, because it is an admission of an intentional guilt act.
Well, wait a second. Maybe I misunderstood. If defense counsel puts on a medical expert, couldn't that medical expert indicate that because of A, B, and C disorders, this person has no capacity to understand right and wrong?
He may. And in fact, in the end, in this case, they chose not to put their mental health expert on it because he couldn't do any of the things that he wished to do. And in fact, would not have been able to put on...
But my point is that establishing mental illness does not have to include establishing guilt. So you could have your medical expert establish the mental illness and still saying, you know, he's not guilty, but just in case, we've got mental illness.
Your Honor, the reality is that the defense ends up asking and arguing to find him guilty but mentally ill. That means that defense counsel gets up and says, yes, if you believe that the state proved this beyond a reasonable doubt, he is in fact guilty, but he is mentally ill. And that undercuts the defendant's right to have an innocence-based defense. And that's what the defendant said. All Cook said is this one type of defense, guilty but mentally ill, is so akin to otherwise a guilty plea or the other areas in which they have a fundamental right, a defendant has a fundamental right to make a defense or to make his own personal choice, that you cannot impose it over his objection. And that's what the trial judge understood here. I apologize.
No, I'm sorry. You were finishing your answer to Justice Berger's question. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I did finish. I'm sorry.
Are we having a problem to some degree because there's an insufficient record before the trial judge on what the defendant's objective might have been and what strategies that may have been inconsistent with that objective defense counsel sought to explore?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And quite honestly, that's one of the most honestly frustrating parts from sitting on my side of the courtroom here. There were no less than 10 office conferences or ex parte proceedings. Ex parte meaning we can't even be there for the purposes of ensuring that the judge gets it right. So we're stuck with a record that is made that we have no way of trying to ensure is appropriate. Now, in Cook, we did, obviously, the court knows. We brought a writ of mandamus before Cook even started to say, get us to where we are today under Cook.
Well, and by way of example, float out this concept of guilty but mentally ill, which statutorily I understood originally was to be a plea alternative. It wasn't going to be part of the mechanics of trial. There would be a hearing about whether someone's mentally ill or not. How could the defense present mental illness evidence here when they didn't say we want insanity as a defense and they aren't asserting extreme emotional distress or diminished capacity? They're asserting as a defense, self-defense, accident, I didn't have the requisite mens rea. What would have been the relevance of any mental illness
expert testimony? Only if they were going for the guilty but mentally ill verdict in the end would it be, Your Honor.
And the record doesn't say that the defendant sought that objective as it applied to any charge, lesser included offense or otherwise, does it?
No. He had... I would suggest that the trial judge did his very best to determine what the objectives of each were. What became clear was that defense counsel believed a strategy that involved seeking a guilty but mentally ill verdict, whether it be including for intentional murder or the lessers, was something they wished to do. Mr. Taylor said, no, I do not want to seek guilty but mentally ill. I do want to seek these other things, accident, self-defense. The trial judge never said, look, you need to go with accident and self-defense. All the trial judge did, and I think that if you look at A-232 and 233, all the trial judge said is, my understanding of Cook is this. You have to take guilty but mentally ill off the table because he's competent. We've been through numerous of these proceedings, and it's clear he does not want it. You do. And he has again said, I understand what they want. I do not want that. And I think that's correctly recalled.
Can you clear up something for me that you said, you know, part of the argument on appeal by Taylor is the judge didn't do certain things that would have been required by Cook. And you alluded to ex parte office conferences, and you seem to imply they exist, but they weren't transcribed, and they're not part of the record on appeal. Is that correct?
No, I'm not saying that they weren't transcribed, but what I am saying, Your Honor, is the state is at a great disadvantage, because what happens is while all of this is going on pre-trial, and the judge may or may not be making the right decisions under Cook, or may not be going under the engaging in the proper inquiry, we're not there. We can't, and yet it was transcribed, and I can tell you that a lot of it was news to us, quite honestly, after the verdict. And so then we are stuck then trying to put together something that we've got to defend in the end. Now, luckily, I believe it is very defensible, because I think the judge did his best and was as patient as possible with them. But what he did, in fact, come down to was there was this rift between counsel and the defendant as to whether or not GBMI would be employed. And reading Cook, I'd suggest he made more than the proper inquiry on it. He said, you are on opposite ends of the spectrum on this. You do not agree. Counsel, all I can tell you is you cannot engage GBMI over his express objection. Now, one of the questions raised here is what the court meant by inquire into the propriety of counsel's representation. What Mr. Taylor's counsel now says is, what that means is the judge has to look at all of the evidence of the defense and whether or not he believes that's the best strategy and then choose it. Cook left no room for the court to make any decision that defense counsel couldn't make and impose that defense over him. That's the same Sixth Amendment violation. It's just done by the court now instead of defense. We suggest that what the court meant, certainly the court knows what it meant, but our best interpretation of it is that inquiry into the propriety simply means finding out if there is that rift and whose position, what are the two positions to get to the point that this trial judge did and said, you do not agree, and the defendant does not want GBMI, you may not employ it over his express objection. We suggest that it's not fundamentally at odds with the right to counsel. The reality is this: effective counsel is basically squared within certain decisions that are made by criminal defendants. Like I said before, effective counsel may want him to absolutely plead guilty and say going to trial is basically going to be a bloodbath. We shouldn't be anywhere near a trial, defendant. But if the defendant says, I want a trial, he or she, the defense counsel, must go forward with it. This is just one of those blocks.
In the situation where someone's charged with a particularly heinous crime, and the defense attorney thinks they should have a bench trial, and hopefully they can convince the defendant to go along. But at the end of the day, if the defendant says, no, I'm not waiving my right to a trial by jury, and then over counsel's best advice, that's one of the decisions a defendant gets to make.
Yes, Your Honor. And this is in that same category. This is one of those decisions under Delaware state law, because of the nature of the verdict you are seeking, whether it be defense or whatever you call it, that he gets to make that call if he is competent. That
no,
defense counsel cannot impose.
It's under the U.S. Constitution as we've interpreted it.
Yes, it does. I meant that the defense is defined under Delaware state law as one that acts as it does, and that is you get a verdict basically of guilty, the same punishment and everything else. But yes, the prescription from doing it comes from the Sixth Amendment, as the court held in Cook. If the court has no further questions at this point, I don't know that I have any other comments to make. As to our other two arguments, I believe those are relatively clear and set forth in the briefs. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is not Cook versus State. Defense counsel did not intend to waive any fundamental rights without his consent. The state's argument ignores the existence of Florida versus Nixon. What's its relevance if every time a defendant objects to guilty but mentally ill, they must pursue that verdict? It is not the same as a guilty plea. Brookhart versus Janus made a distinction. In that case, they wanted a truncated trial, which was the equivalent of a guilty plea. They distinguished that for Nixon, where there was a testing of the case. Here, defense counsel was not going to admit guilt. They were not going to prevent their client from testifying. They were not going to ask for him to be out of the courtroom. They were not going to introduce evidence against him. So this case, reconciling Nixon and Cook, required the court at the very least to conduct what was required in Cook to clarify if the court finds that there's any question in the record that they were required to do that. And at that time, the state was aware of what Cook ruled.
Well, wouldn't they have to introduce evidence against him to support a verdict of guilty but mentally ill?
Absolutely not.
Well, you'd have to introduce psychiatric testimony, correct?
Yes.
Which would include the conclusion that the defendant is guilty but mentally ill?
That he's mentally ill. There does not need to be any connection between the evidence that doesn't support guilt. It supports mental illness. And in this case, it was different than Cook because in Cook, there was a confession in the mental health evidence, and he was denying it altogether. Everything was consistent in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and assess.